Yeah. I'm Neil from Compass, the Good Society Pressure Group. You might be worrying that someone's missing from the panel. Don't worry, he's on his way on a motorbike from Greece. He'll be here shortly. Yanis said that he was going to be in London, and the only night he could do a meeting was a Sunday. And we thought, who the hell comes to a meeting on a Sunday night? But we're Compass, and we'll try anything. And actually, tonight was subscribed four times over. We put a waiting list on it, and you know, we could have got 2,000 people out tonight. Why could we have got 2,000 people out tonight? Well, partly because we're a fantastic organisation, but partly because something's going on. And it isn't the going on of Dave's dodgy deal, and it isn't the going on of Boris deciding and calculating what's ever in the interests of Boris. It's something bigger and more important than that. It's about what kind of Europe we want. Because we don't want the Europe that's on the ballot paper. We don't want just to stay or leave. We want a different kind of Europe, a transformed Europe. Because we know that a crash is looming. Another crash is looming. We know that climate change is burning the planet and flooding the planet at the same time. We know that mass immigration is now a feature of a world that's gone global and is not going to stop going global. And we've got to do something about all of those issues. And we know that we can learn from Scotland and their referendum, that it isn't just a question of in or out, stay or go. That people, when they're given the chance and the opportunity, use a ballot, use a referendum like that, a decisive one, to not just stay or go or be in or out, but to reimagine what kind of society and what kind of world they want. And that's what we have to do between now and June the 23rd and relentlessly before that and after that. Use the opportunity to reimagine what kind of Europe we want. Because we don't just have votes. We don't just have votes. We have hearts and minds, we have imagination, we have love, we have solidarity, we have care, we have compassion, we have a desire to be cooperative. We have all of those things. And the ballot, the referendum, is just a backdrop to use all of those things, to think about the kind of Europe we want, the Europe that we want to build. And so it's not just about tonight, it's not just about the weeks and months leading up to June the 23rd, and it isn't just about what happens on that day. It's about what we do relentlessly to build the kind of Europe we want, to build the networks of activists, campaigners and politicians to create the kind of good Europe that's in our hearts, the Europe that we know that we need. So I'm very grateful for everyone being here tonight. Don't panic, Yanis will be here. But before he gets here, we've got a fantastic panel who will start the conversation and then bring you into it. And on the panel we have, hosting and facilitating tonight, the marvellous Mary Calder, who's Professor of Global Governance here at the LSE. Welcome, Mary. Thank you very much for being here. We have Caroline Lucas, who's the Green MP for Brighton Pavilion. I think you're quite popular, Caroline. And we have Zoe Williams, the absolutely fantastic journalist from the Guardian. Thank you. Mary, over to you. Thank you very much.
Well, because I'm only going to talk for a very short time, I'm not going to stand up, but I want also to welcome you all on behalf of the LSE. And it's great that we managed to do this on a Sunday night. And like Neil, I think it's an incredibly important moment at which we really can try to talk about how we change Europe and get a conversation going that goes on beyond the referendum. And what I really hope is that everybody here will join in on thinking about how we might do this and what we might do. So I'd like to make it as interactive as I can. So what I'm going to do is, the plan originally was to have a conversation with Caroline, Zoe, and Yanis, and we will have the conversation when Yanis arrives, but I thought I would ask Caroline and Zoe the first question and have them give their answers, and then I would throw it over to the floor for people to ask us our questions or to make suggestions. And then when Yanis comes, we'll go back to the conversation. How does that sound? We think Yanis will get here in about half an hour. Well, oh, less than half an hour now, because it's already 7:15. He was on the Heathrow Express about half an hour ago. Oh, no, on his motorbike. So, I'm going to start by asking Caroline, and I'm going to ask them both the same question, which is what Caroline thinks is the purpose of the European Union in the 21st century.
Well, thank you, and I'm very honoured to be a warm-up act for Yanis Varoufakis. Anytime he wants me, I'll do that. I'm happy with that. But I just want to say, first of all, how happy I am to be here amongst all of you this evening, because I have a feeling that the kind of discussion we're going to have tonight, the kind of Europe we're going to be talking about tonight, is about 10 million miles away from the kind of Europe that our Prime Minister has been talking about. Because David Cameron, as you will have noticed, essentially wants a leaner, meaner, narrower European Union. One based on division, not solidarity. One based on erecting fences, not building bridges. One based on fear and not hope. And you'll see he's come back from Brussels and he's proudly proclaiming new barriers to people living and working across the EU, more deregulation for capital and corporations, essentially less free movement and more free trade. And I think it's really important that a message goes from us tonight to say that he is not doing that in our name. He is essentially talking about a dismal, dreary view of Europe. And I think that tonight can be the start of what should be a really interesting conversation that takes the debate about what the EU could be away from the bureaucrats, away from men in grey suits, and has it in our kitchens, in our pubs, in our community centres, so that there's a real dynamic conversation about how we can imagine what the EU could be. And I think this is a real opportunity to talk about the big ideas, not just the kind of the small beans of Cameron's renegotiation, because to be honest, I can't really imagine that many people, you know, poring over the details of when red cards can be used and so forth, and really feeling that's going to be the critical issue that makes their decision for them as to whether or not they want to stay inside the EU. There may be some people that are like that, but not very many. I think for most of us, it's a bigger picture about what kind of country we want to be, what kind of people we think we are, and what kind of future we want for our children. And so I think the question that Mary rightly asks us, what's the European Union for, is an incredibly good question, because it's a question that hardly ever gets asked. You know, we have big debates about do we want more Europe or less Europe, but far less about, you know, what for Europe. And so I think that essentially we need to recognise that the original big idea for the EU, that idea of bringing peace to post-war Europe by binding its nations together with an ambitious free trade project, is no longer enough to sustain public support for the EU, and indeed for some it actually increases their opposition to it. So we are long overdue a debate about a new big idea for the EU, one that is, I would argue, potentially based on putting sustainability and social justice right at the heart of the EU. I think that could revitalise its institutions, re-inspire public enthusiasm that has been eroded by the way of measuring the EU simply in terms of what it's done for big business, what it's done for reducing barriers to trade, this kind of economism which doesn't touch people's hearts and minds at all. You know, we face such huge challenges in the world right now, whether that's the crisis of inequality and austerity, whether it's the accelerating financial crisis, whether it's the climate crisis, and yet we have a predominant economic model that simply responds by urging us, in those wonderful words of Professor Tim Jackson, to spend money we don't have on things we don't need, to make impressions that don't last on people we don't care about. And that seems to be a pretty stupid thing to be doing. For me, the EU really could be a leader in pioneering different economic models that don't cost the earth. It really could be a leader in renewable energies and a different green energy system that doesn't destroy the planet. It could be a real leader in closing the gap between the rich and the poor. And even as I say this, I kind of feel, I'm sure, that there's cynicism in the room saying, yeah, well, we haven't seen much evidence of that so far, have we? And to some extent, I agree with you. But you know what? If you actually look at some of the mechanisms of the EU, some of those tools are already there. The structural funds, for example, are an ambitious mechanism to be able to redirect money from some of the richer EU countries to some of the poorest. That is a real redistributive mechanism that lies at the heart of the EU for us to use. When it comes to the climate crisis, the EU really has been a leader in trying to get the best possible deal, for example, out of the Paris climate talks. Whatever we actually think about that, in terms of the result of Paris, I think it's clear that the EU did play a very positive role there. And I think it's precisely because, you know, the EU is playing this role that, for example, the hedge funds are amongst those who want to see us leaving the EU as soon as possible because they don't want the financial regulation. It's one of the reasons that people like Nigel Farage and Bill Cash spend so much time foaming at the mouth, because actually on some of this stuff, the EU can be quite effective. The corporations undoubtedly have too much control over the EU, but nevertheless, the EU has moved forward with a Tobin tax. It has introduced a cap on bankers' bonuses. It is doing far more on financial regulation than the UK. So I want to be really clear that I am not under any illusion that the EU does not need reform. Of course it does. It needs to be made more transparent and accountable, more accessible. It needs to have a different end goal, not more competition and privatisation. But I think we need to make a distinction between the flaws of the EU institutions and the neoliberal policies of the particular governments that we have in the EU right now, because far too often they get conflated, and never more so than in the debate about TTIP. Because many people will say to me, the EU is in the forefront of negotiating the secret agreement, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and they're saying, how on earth can you support an EU that is promoting TTIP? And I have a huge amount of sympathy for that. I hate TTIP too, and I hate in particular that investor-state dispute settlement mechanism at the heart of TTIP, which will allow private companies to sue democratically elected governments. But who is the key cheerleader of TTIP? It is David Cameron, who is already pursuing that same investor-state dispute settlement mechanism in bilateral trade agreements already. It's David Cameron. So I think if people think that by leaving the EU we're going to end up with a lovely, cuddly, gentle trade policy, then I think there's a bit of a wake-up call that is not going to be the case. Again, people understandably are right to criticise on one level what the EU has done on the refugee crisis, or I should say the xenophobia crisis, more accurately. What we see with the rising of fences is absolutely appalling. But again, let's make a distinction between the right-wing governments who are by and large doing that and the bit of the institutions, the EU institutions, the Commission, that actually did come up with a plan based on things like GDP, density of population, growth and so forth, to look at a way of being able to make sure that all of the EU countries were sharing responsibility for taking more refugees. Now, the member state governments threw that back in their faces, but it doesn't change the fact that the EU institutions were actually trying to find a better resolution. So very briefly, in terms of the kinds of policies we would have in this EU that is going to be this pioneer in a different way of working, I think we need a Green New Deal right across Europe. In other words, a massive investment in energy efficiency, renewable energy, that would massively create jobs in Europe, it would get our climate emissions down, it would get people's fuel bills down, it would tackle fuel poverty, it would pay for itself in a very short number of years because of the tax take that you would get from the jobs created. And when you know, people have a debate about where would you find the money from in the first few years to kickstart this. You know, there are so many places we could find that money. We could redirect just a fraction of the money that currently is being earmarked for Trident recommissioning, for example. We could also be taking money from the European Investment Bank, as long as we're still in the EU and we can still use that. We could be massively redirecting the money that's going into the arms trade and elsewhere. Green quantitative easing. You know, we could be using the quantitative easing, the so-called credit creation that's happening, instead of putting that into the private banks, that could be going to kickstart this kind of programme. I think we need a minimum wage for every single worker throughout the EU, not the same wage to begin with, but a base level so that everybody in the EU is able to get a decent wage. Beyond that, and going further than that, I think we need a minimum basic income scheme right across the EU so that none of Europe's citizens are living in poverty. I think that we need new economic models, not based on endless economic growth. Again, Professor Kenneth Boulding had that lovely word, that anyone who thinks that infinite economic growth on a planet of finite resources is possible is either a madman or an economist. So, there are lots of possibilities out there, and I think this referendum is an opportunity to have that national conversation about the EU. And I think that those of us on the left have to recognise that we have been too quiet in terms of saying what's good about the EU as well as what's bad about it. I stress again, I am not under any illusion that the EU needs reform. But I think that if we did not have the EU, we would need to recreate it, because all of the main challenges we face today are cross-border challenges, whether that's climate, international terrorism, the refugee crisis, the financial crisis. We need to be working together. And I think this debate about what kind of Europe we want desperately needs some visionary and inspiring voices. It desperately needs an injection to get people to imagine the EU that we could have. And then through the kinds of movements that Yanis is involved in, his DiEM movement, Democracy in Europe, we can build that at a pan-European level. So I think there's all to play for, and I really welcome this opportunity to start the debate tonight. Thank you.
Wonderful. I so agree that if we didn't have the European Union, we would actually have to invent it.
Yeah, but what would it look like?
It might look different, but that's what we'll try and do. But getting rid of it would make things much worse.
Yeah.
So I'm now going to ask the same question to Zoe, and I don't know whether you want to stand up or sit down.
I don't really want to stand up.
You can stand up.
I'm going to take 5 minutes quite literally, if that's all right. So the last time I wrote a column about the EU and the referendum, I said, you know, we need to make the argument, if we're going to make the argument to be in, we need to make the argument based not on what it looks like now, but on what it could be, because what it looks like now is terrible. And, you know, there's very little kind of social democratic energy in defending it as it stands at the moment. And this was just after Greece, actually. So it was, you know, very piquant at the time that Europe didn't seem like a very democratic institution, and there didn't seem to be much solidarity going on, and all the kind of principles by which it was established didn't seem to be operating very well. But you know, that didn't mean that we couldn't imagine what it was supposed to look like in order to create something that we then wanted to vote for. And maybe imagining that thing would be useful as an exercise, because if you say this is what a good Europe would look like, you inadvertently say this is what a good UK would look like, and this is what a good future would look like. And you, there are lots of things that you articulate and give shape to that then kind of create bonds between movements that otherwise maybe wouldn't realise how much common ground they had, I don't know, between the refugee charities and green ones, for instance, as a kind of wild for instance. Anyway, then some annoying reader said, okay, so your point in Precy, I think, is we should pretend Europe is the exact opposite to what it is in order to make people vote for it so that we can make it into something else that we haven't yet decided. And that's basically it, yes. there is a huge amount to work on. Nobody could go into this referendum pretending to defend every one of the institutions or every one of the decisions, or even pretending to understand every one of the institutions and every one of the decisions. And I think part of the massive success of the Leaves has been to make it seem so alienatingly boring and complicated that you kind of you don't even want to kind of approach the territory. So far as I'm concerned, the people who've made the best case for Europe have been environmentalists for Europe, which I believe you are part of. And their point is that, you know, they have an actual concrete Europe that has done concrete things over a kind of demonstrable period of time, which wouldn't have been done without it. So the past kind of 40 years Europe has been operating like a union for the environment, which certainly certainly the UK couldn't have done on its own, and certainly wouldn't have happened. You know, you can have all the kind of goodwill towards the environment in the world, but you needed the institutions, you needed the kind of solidity of those institutions in order for people's shared purpose to have some kind of iteration in legislation, right? So Matthew Spencer of the Green Alliance, it said the way Europe was able to do this was that its mechanisms are so slow that once you've put something into law, it would take a generation to unpick it. It would take longer than I'll be alive to actually row back on the British beach or the kind of European beach legislation or the wildfowl, or, you know, so much protection which a British Parliament could unpick in a year once a European director has kind of had its hands on it, would take 25 years. And that was kind of convincing, but also quite depressing. You know, you can't go into a referendum saying, everybody vote for this, because it's so slow that once it's done something, we'll be dead by the time it manages to undo it. And in a way, what we've got to find a way to do, in terms of making a kind of argument for a different kind of Europe, is find a way to appreciate the institutions, because after all, you know, environmentally or in terms of workers' rights or in terms of humanitarian purpose or in terms of anything, there is no point having a kind of a shared response to a xenophobia crisis if you don't have the institutions that can then act on it. How you make those institutions sound a bit sexier than they sound at the moment, I think, is a group project for all of us, because it's more than the work of one man or woman. It's partly that Adorno line that what you've got to discover is not the past, but the dreams of the past. And UKIP is doing a really good job of doing that. And the kind of the opposite to that would be, what were the dreams that went into creating the European Union in the first place? It was partly a humanitarian dream, a kind of belief that you could make a stated humanitarian purpose and people would stand by it, and people would be proud to stand by it, and they wouldn't experience it as pressure or hassle. They would say, I'm actually proud to be a humanitarian nation, which has signed up to the Refugee Convention, for example. I mean, that seems quite distant now, but these are kind of mainly questions of language. It's not. It's within living memory that people were able to make a case for refugees and have people stand up and be proud to sign it. Partly it was humanitarian, partly it was in terms of solidarity, and, you know, much of the kind of European project was a solidarity of one nation's workers to another. Partly, everybody talks about Europe as a kind of trading body now, but the reason they went on about trade was so that they could stop having wars. I mean, you know, nobody set it up in order to take 5% off any tariffs. And now when you look at the British Futures research that says people are turned off by the trading argument. Well, everybody would have been turned off by the trading argument if this is how the argument had started, that things will be cheaper and, you know, your inward investment will be slightly less impeded by your small tax mechanisms. That's not what a trading agreement was meant to be in the beginning. The point of a trading agreement was that you could stop actually killing one another over your trade. And that, you know, these were quite big dreams, and there's nothing to stop us dreaming big again. And there's nothing, I don't think, to stop us articulating what we want to dream about, because it seems really plain that we want to dream about a kind of refugee stroke humanitarian purpose, a solidarity purpose, a modernity purpose, a renewable energy purpose, an environmental purpose. It seems really plain. So I hold out quite a lot of hope, again.
Thank you.
That's okay.
Actually, I think the British government is worse than the European Union, and we don't have a vote to leave this British government. And I think that's how we need to think about it. I mean, the Scots did decide, a lot of them wanted to leave because it was such a horrible government. But I think what we need to think about is not, do we want to leave the European Union because it's horrible? Because we're part of the European Union, and I think you're absolutely right, Zoe. You know, Europe was founded so there would not be another war on European soil. It was founded so there would not be fascism again in European soil. And I fear very much that this would be the beginning of fascism and war. If we start a process of disintegration of the European Union, I think we should never forget that. So I think that's our starting point, and then our second point has to be, we live in a globalised world where all the big problems are across borders. Yes, to be sure, decisions are made in Brussels, but they're also made in the headquarters of Amazon and Google. And unless we have an institution like the European Union, we can never get back our ability to decide about the future. So it's not only that we need the European Union still, because there's still a problem of preventing war and fascism, but it's also that we need the European Union because we live in a globalized world, and if we allow a totally free unfettered globalised world, which I have to admit the neoliberals would love, including the neoliberals in the European Union, but even more so the neoliberals in our government. They hope we'll be even more unfettered if we get out of the European Union. We want to be able to tame globalisation and to make it possible to have something like a social and a green and a peace Europe. So I think there's a contemporary case that has to do with globalisation, and there's a historic case which still remains. Mm. Now, I'm not going to talk anymore. I'm meant to be only the facilitator. So I'm going to, because Yanis hasn't yet arrived, I think it's nice if we open it up to the floor. And are there people who would like to ask questions? I'll go to that gentleman right over there. Oh, there's a roving mic somewhere.
It's very,
yeah, just
very
there.
Oh, no.
And then there was somebody, where was it? Over there.
Afternoon. I had a quick question, just pushing the viewpoint more towards the Eastern European Union and looking at maybe the passive foreign policy of the Americas. Mm-hmm. Where do you think, looking forward to the next couple of decades, does the European, in terms of a security point of view, change with a more active role from the States, now looking in a post-Ukrainian crisis situation and with Syria going on? How does that, what does that affect the security?
Yeah, I think you have to take that, Chair.
I'll take that, but I'm going to take another question over there.
I was listening to the news programmes this morning, and Project Fear was loud and proud as an aspect of the in case. And Project Fear was what was actually cited by the interviewer twice, and that was the term that came out of the No campaign in the referendum. Now, what happened there, that was 55-45 for No to stay in the Union. Mm-hmm. Project Fear will probably win again, but the consequences on the 45%, and actually you're starting at a lot closer margin than the independence campaign started. It was about 30-70. So just a question to say, how do you deal with the legitimate critique about sovereignty, governance, the structure of Europe, the way that it doesn't fit with everyday feeling, sentiment? Because one of the responses to the Scottish consequence should have been federalism. That should have been a constructive, intelligent response to the vote, and it so hasn't happened. So the left needs to, I'm enjoying the conversation already, but we need to stand in the shoes of those who will vote very, very confidently for no and attach ourselves to their critique of not just Europe, but fundamentals of democracy, sovereignty, etc., etc.
Is there? Oh yeah, there over is. There. Why are they all men?
There's a woman.
Thank
there.
You.
Oh, is there a stripy top? Yeah. Oh.
This is probably one. Maybe to Olo or for Carolyn. You said that we shouldn't conflate neoliberal policies with European Union policies, and if we look at financial and especially financial regulation policies in the EU, they seem to me to be fairly aligned with the Financial Stability Board, chaired by Mark Carney, previously chaired by Draghi, both former Goldman Sachs executives. It seems to me that, at least in financial policy and financial regulation policy, one that among the many hurt Greece and Spain and many others, there isn't much to separate between the neoliberal policies in the UK of this government, but also the previous government, and the neoliberal policies in Europe. So how can we reflect on that?
Okay, I'm going to let's come back.
Okay.
And who wants to start?
You do the first one before we forget what it was.
I'll do the first one because I've just completed a report. The High Representative for Foreign and Security Policy is doing a global review of the EU strategy, and I've just finished a report that will be presented to her on Wednesday, so I'm thinking about it nonstop. And What I think is that the EU has a potentially terribly important role with a different kind of security policy from a national security policy. The EU's not a nation state in the making, nor is it a classic intergovernmental organization like the UN. It can be more effective than the UN, but it doesn't have to act in defense of national interest. And my view is that the EU has to have a human security interest, a human rights-based approach, which is very, very different from a classic national security policy. Nation states have this ability to distinguish between the outside and the inside. And outside, it's all about war and diplomacy, and inside, it's about law, politics. And actually, that difference is disappearing in the globalized world, particularly within the EU. So EU security policy has to be more like security policy at home. It's about extending a rule of law outwards. It's about protecting ordinary people and the communities in which they live, wherever they are, whether they're in Syria or Europe. And how we do that requires a very different set of instruments. It might need military forces to protect people, but they'd have to act like police. And actually, trying to extend a rule of law, trying to help people at local levels, is very, very different from a classic military operation. I think at the moment, what you see is that the EU is surrounded by wars, and these wars are the source of refugees, they're the source of ideologies, extremist ideologies, they're the source of transnational crime. And unless the EU develops a policy to address them, it would be very difficult for the future, precisely because all the other approaches fail. Airstrikes make things worse. The situation in Aleppo at this moment is just horrendous. Top-down peace processes also make things worse because they, as it were, legitimize all the criminals. What you actually need is a very different kind of bottom-up process supporting, in places like Syria and Libya, there are local ceasefires, there's civil society, there's a lot more different things you can do. Now, a lot of what the EU does already is in this direction, actually, and people don't often know that the European Union has an external security and defence policy that is much more human rights-based than national security policy, but it's not nearly strong enough and effective enough because it doesn't have the political buy-in of nation states. Mm. So pushing on that, for me, is a very important aspect of the future of the European Union. And I could go on for hours, but I won't.
Yeah, I mean, look, the only thing I'd add to that is that at the moment they do seem to have a fatal lack of confidence. There's a kind of real, there doesn't seem to be any appetite for solving or even intervening on anything. And with the kind of lack of confidence, what you really notice with the refugee crisis is that they're pretending the reality is other than what it is. So you've got this situation with, you know, nearly a million people coming through Greece and from Turkey, and their solution is to give the Turks 3 billion euros to stop them coming. Now, it doesn't stop them coming, and you think, okay, well, that's the European Union all over. They pretend the reality is not what it is, and they spend a lot of money pretending it's not what it is, and they don't get the solutions they want. But actually, what they're creating is a situation, they're kind of perverting the money supply. They're funneling so much money into the hands of people traffickers that they're kind of creating a shadow economy with their own self-delusional Absolutely. Policy. And that, I think, that's why I think, and I'm a bit of an optimist like this, I think they're so far along the kind of deluded road that they're bound to sort it out soon. But maybe that's wrong. But you know, yeah. But anyway, sorry.
Should we do some of the other?
Yeah, I think the legitimacy and democracy question we should deal with too. Yeah.
Can I just come back to the question over there? Because I think I probably wasn't quite clear enough. I wasn't saying that the UK was horrible and neoliberal and other EU member state governments were all nice and kind. I was saying that there's a distinction to be made between the European institutions, as in the actual structures of the EU, and the current incumbents of the Council of Ministers, the Prime Ministers and so forth, who are predominantly right now right-wing. And that's my point. I wanted to remember, for example, there was a glorious moment in the 90s when it was the EU15, and for a few short years, there was a majority of environment ministers who were from the Green Party. And you know what? We had some lovely, far-reaching, ambitious environmental policy as a result. So I'm simply saying that a lot of the output of the EU depends on what you're putting in. And if you're putting in right-wing bigots, then that's kind of, you get out right-wing bigotry.
I had a bit of an answer to that as well, which is just a kind of throwaway thing. There are a lot of ideas at the moment which are quite radical, which are too radical in a way for any one nation state's politics. So the basic citizen's income is a real case in point. Nobody is going to take, no single country is going to say that's a really good idea in its kind of political mainstream, not a single one. But if you had, I think the strength of having kind of 15 networked countries saying it at the same time is kind of bigger than we realise, I hope.
I see that Yanis has finally got here, which is wonderful.
How are you?
Sit here. I'll move to the side. So what we've done so far is asked everybody the same question, so we're going to ask you the question.
Okay.
Which is, welcome, I should say.
It's good to be
very
here.
Very good. Thank to you, Mary. So the question is, what's the purpose of the European Union in the 21st century?
Oh, my goodness.
It's rather a lot to ask.
What a way to be welcomed straight from a very long queue at Heathrow. Well, I suppose that there is no purpose. There are opportunities. Europe can be the realm of shared prosperity, or it can be a postmodern version of the 1930s, depending on how we handle the present disintegration of the European Union institutions. You want me to say more?
Yeah, okay. I want to say, what is this postmodern version of the 1930s?
Well, let's first begin with an observation, a contested interpretation of the facts.
Yeah.
I consider the European Union institutions to be disintegrating at an advanced stage of disintegration already. Wherever we look, whether it is the borders that are being re-erected, the fences that are being electrified, the walls that are being built inside people's minds and hearts, the Eurozone, which is a spectacular failure as a financial design. In Britain, let's say that you won a lottery and you won £1 million. You wouldn't care whether it's deposited in an account in Wales, in Yorkshire, in London. But if you were to win €1 million, you should care a great deal as to whether it's deposited in the Greek bank account, the Portuguese bank account, or a German bank account. That is just evidence of the degree of disintegration. We have a common currency, but we have a fragmenting currency area, which feeds into the loss of the dream of shared prosperity, which feeds into the walls, into the fences, and which feeds into increasing doses of authoritarianism from the European Union institutions that have failed, because this is what happens. Error leads to failure. Failure leads to increased authoritarianism in order to continue with the error. And because there are no checks and balances, there is absolutely no accountability whatsoever. We have exactly the same individuals handling and implementing exactly the same policies, in spite of the fact that they are spectacular failures. So the postmodern 1930s. In 1929, we had the end of an unsustainable debt-fueled growth period due to the bad construction, the terrible construction of the common currency of the era, which was the gold standard. Wall Street collapsed as a result, and then very soon after that, we had the fragmentation of that common currency and Europeans turning against one another. 2008 was our generation's 1929. In our greatest infinite wisdom in Europe, we had constructed the Eurozone along the lines of the gold standard of the 1920s. That created Ponzi-fueled growth, exactly as it had done in the Roaring Twenties. And then again, Wall Street collapsed on cue. And then again on cue, we had the fragmentation of Europe and us being turned against one another. So The left makes a very big mistake, thinking that there is a conspiracy, thinking that the powers that be in the institutions have some plan. They're clueless. They make it up as they go along. The debt explosion was not planned. The banking collapse was not planned. They never saw it coming. But when they saw it coming, instead of asking the question, which is what the Americans did, the Americans asked the question, they didn't give a very good answer, but they asked the right question, how do we contain this crisis? In Europe, they didn't ask this question. In Brussels and in Frankfurt, they asked the question, how are we going to pretend that the construction that we had created was sustainable and that the rules can be implemented when we know they cannot be implemented? Yeah. And this is the answers you give to these two different questions are very different, and the answers to the latter question bring about further disintegration. So, if I'm right in my analysis, then we are facing, after our generation's 1929 in Europe, a postmodern 1930s. We already see it in Hungary, in Poland, in Greece. Mm-hmm. We have the rise. I was sitting in my ministerial seat in Parliament, was opposite the Golden Dawn bigots, the skinheads, who were democratically elected. We have similar phenomena everywhere.
Absolutely.
So is this the Europe we're going to fall into, this kind of abyss of the 1930s variety, or are we going to do something better than we managed to do in the 1930s? This is why we need a democratic alliance of the left, of liberals, of the Greens, to do that which the generation of the 1930s failed to do.
I agree. I agree. But we need it on a European basis and not on a national basis, presumably.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
The nation state can no longer provide the cocoon that some people imagine that it can provide. Mm. Think of all the important issues, refugees, climate change, the dearth of investment. Do you realize that, something few people understand, that Germany today has the lowest level of investment since 1945, even compared to 1946? Yeah? In a country which is extremely rich, which has huge surpluses, and negative interest rates. You have negative... People actually pay money for you to lend from them. Yeah? And we have zero investment, or very low investment. You realize that something is seriously rotten in the heart of the nation state. And, okay, I campaigned in the 1990s against Greece entering the Eurozone. I campaigned against the creation of the Eurozone. Why? Not because I had anything against the idea of a monetary union. As an economist, I thought that this monetary union was equivalent of removing the shock absorbers of your car and driving it into a pothole. Okay? But once you're in, what will happen now if this terrible euro of ours collapses? Very briefly, what will happen? What will happen is a fault line, huge fault line, is going to appear along the Rhine and north of the Alps. The northeast of Europe is going to become a Deutschmark zone, which will become a black hole of deflation. Prices will be falling. Investment will be even lower than it is now. And the working poor of Germany are going to become unemployed poor. Not a good development from a European perspective. The rest of Europe is going to become a stagflationary hellhole with high inflation because our new currencies will devalue massively and very high unemployment. Now, do you think Britain is going to escape this unscathed? No. The whole world is going to be damaged seriously by that. This is why we can't pretend to ourselves that the solution is to say, this was a bad idea. It was a bad idea. The way we constructed it was a bad idea. But there are no easy recoiling into the cocoon and the bosom of the nation state.
Of course, Ulrich Beck argued it was a terrible idea, and the founders of the Maastricht Treaty knew it was a terrible idea, but they thought because it was such a terrible idea, it would bring about political union, rather in the way that the Monnet method, the idea of economic integration, was supposed to lead to political union. And in some ways, they may be right. I mean, if you think about the introduction of bonds or banking supervision, saving the euro might enforce
greater political unity.
That's what they thought. You're right. There was a meeting in September 1992 in Brussels, and there were three men in the room. It was Mitterrand, it was Delors, and it was Stuart Holland.
Oh.
Stuart is a great friend of mine and somebody we've been working together for years and years and years. And Stuart tells me this story. Delors, influenced by Stuart, was proposing Eurobonds and an investment program to Mitterrand. And he was telling him that you can't just have one leg, a giant with one leg, it's unstable, you can't just have the central bank, you need an investment program for Europe. What you would expect Delors to say under the influence of Stuart. And he spoke for 40 minutes, and Mitterrand looked at the ceiling for 5 minutes, which is a very long time to have the French president being silent. You know, And then he turned to Delors and said, "You're absolutely right, but we're not doing it. And we're not doing it because we don't have the political power, Helmut Kohl and I, to do it. But, as Mary just said, we will create this monetary union. And for the reasons you are putting forward to me, Jacques, when a financial crisis hits, in 10 years' time," he actually said 8 or 10 years, he was a few years off, "then our successors will have to do what you're saying." But he was profoundly wrong, Mary. And you know why he was wrong?
Oh, yeah.
For reasons that your father described brilliantly in that New Statesman article in 1971, in which Kaldor said, in that it is a terrible mistake to think that by pushing forward the monetary union through this method, you are creating or facilitating a political union. If you do that, you will end up with a Europe that will be impossible to unify politically. Kaldor, 1971.
I remember, actually. So somebody asked a question which has not yet been answered, and I thought it would be very good to ask you the question and have your answers. And the question was, as you know, Cameron came back from Brussels yesterday claiming a great deal, which is pretty ridiculous. But now this campaign for a referendum has begun. And the question is, how does the left answer the question of the right about sovereignty, democracy, and legitimacy? And so I'm going to ask all three of you to answer that question. Who wants to start?
Well, I think we should not be defensive about it. I mean, we've got options here, haven't we? We can either be defensive or we can go on the offensive in a very kind and gentle way. And I think we should be absolutely saying that there is something rather noble about the prospect of people coming together, deciding in the greater good to pool a certain degree of sovereignty. Because it's so interesting that the same people that froth at the mouth at the idea of losing some kind of sovereignty within the EU are the same ones who are giving it over hand over glove when it comes to corporations, when it comes to the World Trade Organization, when it comes to TTIP. They don't even think twice about it when it comes to that environment. Mm. And yet it's a very convenient argument for them to suddenly come upon when it comes to the EU. And it seems to me that the benefits of working together are so much more visible and evident when it comes to the climate crisis or when it comes to the refugee crisis or international terrorism or financial crisis, all of these things. We are going to be stronger if we work together. And so to be quibbling, in a sense, about some sense of what this sovereignty really means, I think is disingenuous. And I think as well that in order for sovereignty to mean anything, you've got to have the power to actually put it into practice. I mean, sovereignty is a hollow thing if you've got no power. And if you think of the UK on its own there, separated from the rest of the EU, you know, trying to get information out of the EU, trying to persuade the EU not to put up trade barriers over a certain issue, you know, we might be able to have our cherished sovereignty that we can hold to our heart and feel very happy about. But actually, in terms of making it operational, in terms of having influence, in terms of making it effective, I think we're going to struggle. So my answer to it would be that let's say, hurrah, what a wonderful example of countries actually working together for the common good and challenge the right when they fail to make those same arguments when it comes to the power that is going to the corporations, which they hand over to them, the power that they willingly hand over in the World Trade Organization. There is a real logical inconsistency in the arguments of the right, and I think we should point to that. Mm.
Zoe. Okay, so this question was about Scotland, right? And there was no positive case to be made for union with England. There just wasn't. So the no's got all the hope, and the yes's got all the... No, the yes's got all the hope, and the no's got all the fear, and fear won. And that's, I think, the same thing happened in the general election, actually, because there was no positive case, there was no hopeful case made, so fear won again. There is a positive case to be made that doesn't have to be just status quo with this. And I think if we fixate on whether or not it's taking control of your own destiny and whether your own destiny can be controlled within a kind of wider environment of cooperation, I think that's the wrong focus. So I think if we kind of get too hung up on sovereignty, then we'll always be at the mercy of some kind of daft UKIP argument that somehow if we seceded, we'd you know, have this chariot of fire that we could pursue our own interests and everything would be great. I think that really what all they're doing is conjuring up a better future, which so far the kind of strong Britain stronger in has failed to do. Now, I can see why they failed to do it in a way, because as soon as you start talking about a kind of utopia, talking about utopias, then you lose all the security and the status quo and the everybody be cool and look down and we'll all be fine. You lose that kind of the generation of fear that makes people vote for you in the first place. So I can see why they don't want to make a positive case, but I don't think that should stop us.
So, Yanis, do you have a view?
Of course I have a
view. Pretty sure.
I was taught at a very young age, due to my Marxist upbringing, to have a view about everything and and to remain optimistic in the absence of all evidence that good things will happen.
You're a Gramsci.
Yes, indeed. But let's begin with David Cameron. He came back with the mother of all Eurofudges to address a population, an electorate, that is sick and tired of Eurofudges. So there is a delicious irony there. The two cardinal sins were firstly this, and secondly, to not touch the question of sovereignty. Mm. The Eurosceptics have a legitimate case. Those who, on a Burkean kind of frenzy, come to the conclusion that Britain is better off outside the European Union, due to their commitment, at least theoretical commitment, to the sovereignty of Parliament and so on, they have a very interesting case. I disagree with them, and I'll tell you why I disagree with them, because at the same time they want to be part of the single market. Mm-hmm. And you cannot have a single market unless you have common industry standards, common labour standards, common environmental standards. And you cannot have those common standards and a judiciary and a system of monitoring and implementing these common standards unless you have pooled sovereignty. So if, when I talk to my friends in the Tory party, and I have them, interestingly, you know, nobody's straightforward in this life, when they say to me, they give me their Burkean narrative, I say to them, yes, but drop the single market. Maybe you can talk about free trade, but that's not the same thing. You know, remove tariffs, but not a single market. You cannot have a single market if you don't have single sovereignty. And you can have an interesting conversation with them with this. With Cameron, you can't, because he's part of this generation of politicians that are much more interested in PR and completely uninterested in substance. What we need to do is to explain to the average voter in this country, but everywhere else, that either we're going to allow the disintegration of the European Union, which is already happening, give it a push to happen faster, and I told you before why I'm against that, I'm not going to repeat it, or we're going to have to create a democratic European Union. So, in the referendum, I would like to campaign for a third option. Neither Brexit nor surrender to this Eurofudge of Cameron and his mates in the European Union Council. The third option that I would support is to stay in the European Union in order to fight tooth and nail against the anti-democratic institutions of the European Union.
I, I think that's exactly what we should do. We should use this as the start of such a campaign, which I'll try and get our audience to come in a minute. I want to say one thing about this too. I think we should put the democracy argument on its head. We live in a world where sovereignty is being eroded by financial speculation, global finance, by climate change, by wars which we can't affect, by terrorism, by everything. And actually, the only way we can give back citizens to the ability and the capacity to take the decisions which affect their lives, which is exactly what democracy is about, is only if we have an institution like the European Union that can protect us from the bads of globalization. So a campaign to democratize the European Union is also a way not just to make the European Union more democracy, but to bring democracy back to the citizen. And I think that's the argument we have to make. So I'm going to allow a few more questions from the floor. I'm going to let that lady in the striped shirt.
Hello, thank you. So I had a question. It's a question that's asked a lot. I still haven't really have a good answer to, and that's the problem that... sort of the problem of solidarity between countries, and particularly the East, that national politicians have to blame everything on sort of bureaucratic Brussels. That is a sort of thing that very few people actually understand anything about. And sort of how you can bring that solidarity and how you can make sort of national politicians like take away, sort of not always blame Brussels for the hard decisions they themselves have to make, and make sure that maybe sort of like David Cameron also takes into account the, say, like the problems people have in Romania or in France. It's not just about your own national sort of electoral system, or like getting re-elected in your own country.
Okay, I'll take the person in glasses. No, sorry, it's this one. Wrong person. He's got an apple in front of him.
We've talked about sort of almost like two goals here. One, a sort of a more democratic EU, and another, an EU that is more focused on social justice. And I wonder why the panel think that these two necessarily go hand in hand when you have, for example, on refugees, the European Commission, probably the least democratic institution in the EU, is the one proposing, you know, let's share things equally, while it is mostly democratically elected governments that are trying to put up walls.
That's a good point.
So, yeah, that would be my...
That's a good point. Okay, I'm going to take one more. I'm going to take the lady over there.
How does or how should a good Europe respond to Putin's Russia and its sort of seemingly endless attack on individual liberty?
Great question. Mm. Okay, so who's going to start? Oh. Do you want to start, Zoe?
God.
National politicians.
Don't know the answers. Okay, so the first thing about how do you stop politicians blaming the kind of bureaucratic... I think the thing is there's a huge amount of... I'm astonished by the coarsening of debate around this. I'm absolutely astonished by it. I did some Vox Pops on Friday where a guy, a Canadian, who was doing a PhD in the traditional music of the Oman, told me that he was fed up with these immigrants coming over who didn't work and had no intention of working and just had a load of kids and just expected the state to support them. And I was like, you're doing a PhD in music and you believe this nonsense. How is that even possible? There are kind of certain narrative tropes, kind of the faceless bureaucrats is one of them, the kind of hyper-fertile, lazy immigrant, and it's like a lazy person wants 8 children. It's ridiculous. Lots and lots of these very kind of two-dimensional pictures, which I couldn't have imagined gaining political currency 15 years ago, have huge, huge currency, not just here in Hungary, in Poland, in France, in Germany.
All I can say is you just have to fight and fight and fight and fight. There's no, you cannot, I mean, I'd love it if we could have a list saying, no, please, please would you refrain, like in swimming pools, please refrain from them making up stupid, idiotic stories about bureaucrats that you can't even identify, you know, the straw men, all the kind of othering and bad faith arguments that you could have identified in the 30s. I wish we could say you're not allowed to do this, but they are allowed to do it, and the only way to tackle it is to kind of fight it ceaselessly. Now, the thing about kind of democracy being interchangeable with social justice and that not being the case, you're absolutely right. You know, the UNHCR is completely gobsmacked at how much resistance they're meeting from individual governments on refugee questions that they thought was a matter of kind of settled policy 40 years ago. But again, that is, it's how much coarsening of the political debate you're prepared to take within your kind of nation, within the kind of nation and kind of cross-border culture, and how much of a fight you put up. And I just currently don't think we're putting up any kind of a fight. Putin's Russia, that is a late in the day kind of a question. Soros's point about he thinks Putin's deliberately trying to destroy the EU, that's common knowledge, is it?
So, I don't know if it is.
Is it? Oh, okay, Soros didn't say that. He definitely didn't say that.
No. Okay. He's written an op-ed. I didn't think it was common knowledge here.
George Soros's point, which was quite chilling when he said it, but I don't know, I've heard a lot of people since disagree, was that, you know, Putin's whole project is to drive refugees into Europe, to expose the flaws in it and destroy it. And the purpose of that project is, because if Russia's going to go down in 2017, then it wants to take the rest of Europe with it. Now, that...
I don't think it's got anything to do with American
war. Well, look, I mean... What do you mean? What the fuck's Putin got to do with Russia? Sure. But listen, these things aren't mutually exclusive. America can be blowing people up and Russia can be blowing people up. And that is what's happening.
And maybe the European Union is the peace project.
Well, yeah. Quite conceivably. The point being that, look, you don't need to choose whether or not you're going to think Putin's a bad thing or America's a bad thing. You can disagree with both policies. It doesn't have to be tribal. Okay, but you can disagree with Putin at the same time, right? Oh, okay. Okay, fine. Look, you can agree with Putin. You're doing exactly what the EU isn't doing, which is it's not saying I agree with Putin, it's not saying I disagree with Putin, it's pretending it's not happening, and that is not sustainable. Okay. Anyway, I've got to see to Caroline.
Shall we tell the EU about who we're going to implement as the new vassals there? And what did she say? And the telephone conversation was acting as theft. You want to go online, you can find it.
Okay.
Fuck the EU.
Okay. Oh, yeah, no, I'm sure. Sure. Yeah, no, I don't doubt it. Over to you.
Right, I'm not quite sure how to follow that, but going back to the question of solidarity and how to stop politicians blaming Brussels, I just was thinking that we haven't said much tonight of the many different institutions and so forth that we've been criticising. We've not really said much about the media, so it seems a good point to bring in the right-wing media at this point. Because so much of the myth that is, you know, circulating around the straight bananas and the hair dryers that can't be beyond a certain level of noise and so forth are not actually based on fact. They are based on right-wing editorials in lots of our media who just, you know, presumably sit there the whole day looking for these kinds of stories and making them up and taking competitions to see who can make up the most far-fetched story. So I think that, you know, it's a great shame that we don't have a more diverse media in this country, and that is part of a much bigger debate. But I think that it's no accident that there is an agenda in those right-wing papers to, you know, to blame Brussels when anything goes wrong, and when Brussels does something right, then obviously the member state governments will take all the credit and pretend Brussels had nothing to do with it. So that is the problem we have, I think, with our media. On the issue of social justice and democracy and the extent to which those two are can be synonymous or not, I thought it was a really good question. And I think that one of the reasons that that the Commission can perhaps afford to be more compassionate and forward-thinking when it comes to the refugee crisis and member state governments haven't is, dare I say it, because of the pusillanimity of so many of our politicians, that they are not prepared to show leadership on this. And I'm afraid I would put the left into that category as well. I mean, it's not very long ago since we had the Labour Party producing their lovely red mugs that said controls on immigration, you know? And so when you've got the left doing that, then it's no surprise that there is so much fear about raising your head and making the positive case for the contribution that people from other countries make in this country. So I think that the left, and you know, I'm including you know myself, I'm not blaming others, I think all of us needs to be louder in making the case and giving our political leaders a little bit more spine when it comes to debating issues like immigration. I don't know if I really want to get into Russia. I think you might.
I'm going to make a green mug.
No, I mean to be serious. I mean I can recognise what I think perhaps some of the debate was about, that when the US does something, perhaps there's less criticism, and when Putin does it, then we all come down on him like a ton of bricks. There maybe is some case to be answered in that. I think that certainly it wasn't helpful for the EU to dangle the prospect of membership of the EU in some sense for Ukraine and other countries. I think that was provocative, and I think, you know, I'm not defending by any moment what Putin has done, but I think that if you want to try and have a more broad debate about it, we can do that. But I think the bottom line is, when it comes to what could a good Europe do about it, then certainly what they could be doing about it is being consistent in our foreign policy, because if there's one thing our foreign policy lacks right across the EU member states is consistency. And B, when it comes to things like imposing sanctions, then if we mean sanctions, then let's do it properly and not try and exclude all of the kinds of oil and things that are actually quite beneficial to us. If we're doing sanctions properly, then do it properly. And if that means hurting ourselves too, then if we're serious about it, then I think we have to do that.
Well, firstly, on solidarity. Solidarity has to go both ways. This idea that, for instance, you know, I refuse to address meetings on solidarity for Greece. I prefer to go to Germany and lend solidarity to German workers who cannot make ends meet, even though they are working for extremely productive corporations and they have to suffer on mini jobs and insecurity and actual poverty. Poverty, the proportion of working Germans who are under the poverty line has increased inexorably over the last 15 years. So it has to work both ways. And solidarity works best if there is hope. And if there is a project for unifying people. So what we would like to do, and I think, you know, with Caroline, we are signatories of a document, the purpose of which is eventually to lead Europe to a situation where we can convene a constitutional assembly where we start from scratch, tabula rasa, and we ask ourselves the question, how can we create a common identity by authoring a 15-page document, which is a constitution of united Europe, in a manner that makes solidarity not just a humanist project, but also a tangible political, economic, social agenda. An environmental agenda, a feminist agenda, an agenda for a Europe that opposes the current disintegrating situation. On the question of refugees, and it was a great question about the incongruity. You have the bureaucrats of the European Union doing good things or suggesting relatively humanist positions regarding refugees, and you have democratically elected governments. We must draw the standard distinction between majoritarianism and democracy. Majorities have a tendency towards rather awful positions when democracy, as we mean it, is lost. The fact of the matter is that parliaments in Hungary, in Greece, in almost everywhere in Europe, have no power. So you can be in government, but you're not in power. When a population realizes that and they lose the dream of shared prosperity and solidarity, then they turn inwards And the only ones who benefit from that are the racists, the xenophobes, the bigots. And then a majority can come up with that. But you see, this is the thing about the European Commission. You know, there is something called nemesis that follows hubris. So the nemesis, that the terrible harvest that Brussels is now facing, was sown by themselves when they deprived parliaments and governments of power. When they came to Greece and crushed us, for instance, last year, what did they think is going to happen when even a left-wing government is forcing impossible austerity upon down the throats of the people? The only defenders of the people in the end become the Golden Dawn Nazis. So if they manage to create a majority out of the Nazis in Greece, then their humanist moments of reflection are going to be drowned in the harvest that they have sown on Putin. We have to be smart about this. Putin is a war criminal. Long before the Ukraine, he flattened Grozny. He killed tens of thousands of people to become president. Nobody in the West cared about that then. He was the blue-eyed boy of the West. My greatest concern as a Democrat is what he does to Russian Democrats, to Russian journalists, to Russian generally Democrats that oppose him. He crushes them. Try to put yourself into the position of a Russian Democrat. The last thing you want is a West that demonizes Russia. The last thing you want is a West that breaks its promises to Russia. When NATO is making encroachments into parts of former Eastern Europe, well, it's still Eastern, former communist Europe, against commitments that they wouldn't be doing that, this is the greatest gift to Putin and the worst service we can provide Russian Democrats. So we have at the very same time, well, actually, no, I'll just repeat my recommendation. Think as a Russian Democrat.
Definitely think as a Russian Democrat. And also, I think, the answer to this question about narrow national right-wing policies is democratizing the European Union. It's the only answer. So that's what we have to keep in mind. I'm going to take two questions, and then we're going to finish. So I'll take that one there. I think, wait a minute, you need a mic.
Thank you. I wanted to try and extend the argument about democracy and national sovereignty and say that argument is only going to bite when it is made into a critique of what national sovereignty fails to deliver and what national democracy fails to deliver. A government in Britain elected an absolute government with no opposition to it, elected on 37% of the vote, not quite that, and that's less than that of 25% of the population, with absolute power. Is this the democracy that we are campaigning to defend when we ask to leave the European Union? And this is an argument to our colleagues on the left that has to be put, because it is a tragedy that so many on the left have fallen for this myth of national sovereignty and of the power we will have to be able to do all the progressive things we've always stood for if we're outside Europe. Europe is the only bastion of partial defense we've had over the last decade. And yet our friends, close friends and colleagues, many of them, are still falling for this. I think it's absolutely essential that our campaign to stay in Europe is also a campaign of criticism of British democracy, of its failure to be democratic, and of its failure, and of its failure in, and its failure to deliver social protection.
I'm going to take the person right at the back.
What is it? What's this idea about?
I don't know what he's about.
I don't know.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, taking a slight different tack, with the world about to go over the cliff of climate change, how do we get the EU to actually become an institution that takes us to a zero-growth world where we change the measure of growth to something more along the lines of, are we healthy and are we happy?
Sounds like a question for Caroline. I think let's take those questions, but we've actually only got, oh no, we've got 10 minutes. So let's take those questions, but let's take the questions and then we'll summarise. So I'll ask Caroline first, since it's a question for her, but then we can go back to the question about, which was really a comment.
Well, I hope it's a question for everybody, because climate catastrophe isn't going to be nice for anyone, and therefore we all have an interest in exactly answering the question that you've posed: what role can the EU play in terms of accelerating our shift to a zero net growth world, if you like, a zero carbon world? And I think actually that the EU, there's a real kind of conflict at the heart of it. On the one hand, there are some wonderful directives that are coming out and some, you know, work being done on things like the circular economy, the idea that there is no such thing as waste, that you're actually properly designing into your products, the idea that you're going to be able to reuse them at the end of their life. You know, the EU is a real leader on some of that stuff, and that's very exciting. At the same time, they are also the leader in wanting to have a yet more competitive economy with more and more growth. And that is the absolute kind of tension that is at the heart of the EU institutions at the moment. So the answer to your question, in a sense, is how do we give more muscle to the idea that the shift towards a circular economy, a zero carbon economy, is going to win out? And I guess part of that is about talking about the broader benefits that are going to come from that. And it's the same kind of argument that we have here at home as well. I mean, we know as Greens that if we paint a picture of a greener world that is essentially, you know, basically saying that we've all got to sit around a candle in a cave wearing hair shirts, that is not a very compelling and exciting vision, and it's not going to bring people with us. But if we can talk about the benefits of a zero carbon world in terms of the freedom it will give us then to be able to meet our needs, yes, but then also let's imagine the freedom it will give us to spend more time with our families, to spend more time breathing cleaner air, having roads with fewer cars on them. You know, we could actually paint a picture of a much more positive future. And I think all of us, and the Greens prime among us, have to get better at painting that positive future so that people aren't just moving towards a zero carbon future out of fear of the alternative. We know fear isn't a terribly positive motivator. We talked about that earlier. But if you've got to actually imagine, you know, a world where perhaps they're working fewer hours, you know, they are able to spend more time, as I say, with their family and friends, and stuff matters less, then I think that can be quite an attractive proposition. Not many people, you know, go to their deathbeds thinking, I wish I'd spent more time in the office, I wish I'd acquired more stuff. They go to their deathbeds usually thinking, you know, it would be nice to have hung around a bit longer so I could have had, you know, more time with people that I love. So I think, you know, there's all to play for there, and it's the same debate whether it's at EU level or at the national level. The other question was, yes, marvellous, democracy. Couldn't agree with you more about the campaign for a more democratic EU also being a campaign for a more democratic UK. And I just, you know, taking a leaf out of Zoe's book about being hopeful and optimistic, I do feel a bit more hopeful and optimistic about that than I have done in the past, in the sense that we've got the unions who are now coming out and saying that they are happy to look at electoral reform. We've got Labour under Corbyn being much more pro electoral reform, and John Trickett in the shadow cabinet has got this job of going around and setting up this constitutional convention, which hopefully will be a real conversation in the country about what kind of constitutional settlement we want, including the voting system. There was a meeting just last week with seven different political parties represented, including the Conservatives and UKIP, all of whom were talking about how do we bring about electoral reform. So it feels to me like there is some momentum there. I think probably Labour is looking at the writing on the wall and recognising that they're unlikely to form a government on their own next time around. So there are some good pragmatic reasons as well as the principled reasons for saying that there's some hope, I think, between about getting momentum behind this and making that absolutely at the heart of our EU campaign as well.
Oh, I hope you're right. I'm afraid this government's going to try and do boundary changes and registration
but
so they can stay
for the progressives
forever.
To work together.
Yeah,
maybe we'll just wake up to that in time and stop fighting the life out of each other and letting the Tories come through every time. Maybe we might just wake up.
So would you like to add something?
Firstly, on the question of democracy, the very short-lived Athenian experience, classically, offered us an interesting definition of democracy, which is, of course, now confirmed in the breach. Right? And that is the idea of, according to Aristotle, democracy is a constitution in which the free and the waged laborers control government, being in the majority. Yeah? But our liberal democracy starts with the Magna Carta, which was, of course, a charter for masters, safeguarding their rights against the king on the one hand and the peasants on the other. And therefore, the first past the post is simply a reflection of that. It was how to prevent the hoi polloi from controlling government through means that constrain their capacity to have isigoria, that is, equal weight in terms of their opinions regarding outcomes. Now, that's a highly imperfect system of democracy. But the European Union is even worse, because it was created as a cartel of heavy industry. Then we co-opted, they co-opted French farmers, the car industry, and so on and so forth. And they are administrators of a cartel who, of course, disdain the very concept of any kind of democracy, even oligarchic Magna Carta-based democracy. So in attacking them and democratizing Brussels, we get an opportunity to rethink the constitutions of our nation states. Oh. On the question of development as opposed to growth, it's good and fair to have great projects in Brussels about waste, about recycling, about this and that and the other. But we are not going to shift. We're not going to make the green transition without serious money being invested in it. So the question is, how do we do it? We don't have the time to have this discussion now, but let me just offer a hint. Instead of printing 65 billion euros a month, 65 billion a month to buy German government bonds, that really doesn't help at all. Yeah? How about having this kind of firepower being utilized to buy European Investment Bank bonds in a Green New Deal context, that channels 5, 6, 7% of euro area GDP into these technologies?
Agree.
Can somebody tell us why you're not doing it?
We could also have a Tobin tax and a tax on multinationals and a tax on carbon at European level, which could also, we could raise lots of money to fund a new deal.
Well, stop the double Dutch-Irish sandwich to begin with.
Yeah. Zoe, do you want to add anything?
There's one thing, two tiny weeny things I'd add. One is, that on the question of sovereignty, we've got this problem of like a first past the post, needing electoral reform really urgently, nobody ever wanting to do it, nobody voting for it when you do ask them if they want it, and everything being, and it looking very unrepresentative. But the kind of twin problem is that once they get onto the green benches, there isn't very much they can do. And the kind of levers between the kind of political class and the important decisions appear to have been subverted, right? And that's weirdly a point of confluence between the right and the left, the kind of real classic kind of center right left Labour people are constantly saying that there's, you know, the public overestimate how much power we have, while the kind of external critics of the parliamentary democracy are saying, I doubt the kind of financial sector stroke any other sector loses a minute's sleep over who's the leader of the opposition or even who's the leader of the government, you know. In a way, it feels like you could spend a lot of effort just concentrating on the electoral system while you've still got those kind of internal and external critics agreeing that there isn't much, you know. The other thing, the only other thing about the climate change thing is the kind of most hopeful idea about climate change in the European context is the European supergrid and the kind of exchange of renewable energy from one bit of Europe to another. And whenever you see that really as a metaphor and a practical solution is really, really effective. It really cheers people up, the idea that you could actually make cooperation meaningful, because when it was windy in Denmark, they could have the energy in Spain. And it really works as both a kind of infinite fire idea and a cooperative kind of new solidarity, not to mention luxury automated communism. You know, this is how to get somewhere, but that's going to take quite a lot of money.
Okay, so I'm going to let each person have a minute each, because we've run out of time, and followed by Neil, on how can we establish a campaign to democratise Europe in the course of the current, the next 3 months, before we have a vote on June the 23rd.
I'm definitely not going first.
Okay. Yanis knows the answer.
Well, I do, because we started it on the 9th of February okay. in Berlin, and we called it DiEM, Democracy in Europe Movement. And we have a very simple agenda, to democratize the institutions of the European Union, and to do it in three steps. Firstly, by demanding immediate transparency. Would it not be great if, during the European Union Council, when Cameron was doing his shenanigans there, all these discussions were live-streamed so that we would know what they are saying on our behalf? Wouldn't it be good if we had all the TTIP documents published so that we can see what kind of sovereignty is being given away? So we are starting a campaign for transparency now. Secondly, and that's the greater challenge, how do we reconfigure existing institutions of the European Union within the current terrible rules and treaties in order to stabilize the following four realms in which the crisis is destroying Europe? Firstly, public and private debt. Secondly, banks. Thirdly, very low investment, especially in the green transition. And fourthly, poverty. We believe, and this is not for now, that within a few months, the existing institutions, under the existing rules, with a more... a smarter, if you want, a more imaginative interpretation of those rules, can stabilize Europe. Not make it a great place, but stabilize it in order to stop the disintegration and going into this abyss that we describe later. Banking, an anti-poverty fighting fund that operates throughout Europe and which is being funded by the accumulating profits within the European system of central banks. Because if we do that, then we can shift to the next stage, which is the process that will lead to the convening of the Constitutional Assembly that we talked about before. We believe that this kind of 10-year plan, if you want, for the European Union has what it takes to mobilize Europeans from Finland all the way to Portugal and from Greece all the way to Scotland, in order to begin the conversation that in Europe, as Europeans, we have failed even to commence.
Great. Fantastic. Caroline.
Well, I just want to say how important I think that the DiEM25 momentum and process is, the one that you've just been hearing about from Yanis, not least because I think that when those of us in the UK during this referendum programme are going to be talking about the need to make the EU more democratic and accountable and transparent and accessible, it'd be very easy just to dismiss that as a few people in the UK, what difference can that make? And yet when we can really demonstrate that this is part of a pan-European grassroots movement that is growing right across the continent, then I think that becomes something much more interesting and exciting and unstoppable. And I know Yanis has just come straight from another meeting that was in Madrid, the Plan B. So again, there's another process going on too, where these same debates are happening. I was just following their Twitter feed earlier today, and Zoe Constantinopoulou was saying, any politician who says there's no alternative is defrauding their people and defrauding their democracy. And that's a really exciting thing. The same debates that we're having right now have been happening presumably in Madrid just a few hours ago. They were happening in Berlin just a few weeks ago. And hopefully they'll go forward and become part of our narrative when it comes to this EU referendum campaign. So I would love to see, to try to answer Mary's question, the Good Europe campaign that's part of Compass is working. I'm sure Neil will say a few words about that. But I hope that will marry up with DiEM and Plan B. I hope that Another Europe is Possible, which is another broad umbrella group that is basically reimagining what Europe could be like. That can be part of it too. Our challenge here, I think, is to make sure that we don't fragment ourselves too much, that these have to be added together, coordinated, and work together. But I think we've got the most exciting opportunity that I can ever remember in terms of building this pan-European movement. And, you know, it might not be successful, but the one way we can guarantee it won't be successful is we don't even try. And I think we've got the best opportunity in front of us now to try to do that. And so I want to end with the lovely quotation that I always end these things on, so I apologise for those who've heard it 20 times before. But I wanted to paraphrase the wonderful Arundhati Roy. When she said about the world, I shall say it about Europe, that another Europe is not only possible, but she's on her way, and on a quiet day I can hear her breathing.
I mean, I think the Scottish example is the example that we want to follow, really. I mean, you know, they created out of a very boring... The Scottish referendum was very boring in its original conception. It was just a border. Who wants a border? I mean, there was nothing exciting at all about the proposition, and they made the proposition exciting by attaching a huge number of dreams and hopes to it. Now, they did that in tandem with a huge critique of the existing order. I think we've got the critique of the existing order down, and I think we have work to do on the hopes and dreams. I think the problem is we don't have very much time. I would have preferred it if it was next year, but, you know, what can you do? The other thing to take from the Scottish experience is that the referendum doesn't actually stop the conversation, and this conversation won't stop whatever we do. Our place in it might stop. Let's hope it doesn't. But this conversation doesn't stop, and that's what makes it kind of worth doing. It's not just between now and June. It's now and onwards.
I really hope we'll take this opportunity to bring together all these different movements, DM. And I keep hearing more and more. I keep getting emails from different people all over the place. So I think if we could invite them all to London to help us with this campaign and have a really big event, and I invite Yanis straight away.
We're going to be here. You can't get rid of us.
Then that's what I think we should do next. Yeah, I'll hand over to Neil.
I think that's absolutely right, Mary. And something else was formed tonight. Yanis mentioned Golden Dawn. And just to say that in a small way, me and him have started the Skinheads for a good Europe and a democratic Europe. And if we want to find a route between surrender and exit, well, I'm up for another third way, if that's a direction that we can go in. I'd like to thank everyone who's been involved in making tonight happen. Claire, Dominica, Jackie, Dan, Sebastian, Aisha, the people from Philosophy Football who've made some wonderful T-shirts, and please buy them on the way out. And our panel, Mary, Yanis, Caroline, and
Zoe. Don't forget
Zoe.
Dominica.
I did say Dominica. I'm trying to mention everyone because that's the Compass way to recognise everyone and attribute everyone. So we're launching this Good Europe campaign, which can work in tandem with Yanis's DM, that we want to try and create not cacophony but symphony, and that's why tonight is so important. We'll be kind of working on a manifesto over the next few months and weeks in the run-up to June 23. So if you're not a member of Compass, please join and help us do that, because Britain is going to be the crucible of debate for this over the next few weeks and months. So we have to make the most of it, and we have to invite Europe into our conversation to make us stronger, but also to recognise that there are those lights all across Europe where people are having the same debates and the same conversations. Because, look, we live in a Europe that's a utopia. A utopia. It's not our utopia. It's the utopia of the people, the new right, the neoliberals, who dared to dream and create, the people with the ambition and the commitment to make something happen. We're better than they are. We have bigger dreams. We have better dreams. We have to put together now in this opportunity the networks, the ideas, the policies, the vision, the program, the theory of change for our country and for our continent. If they could do it, we can do it bigger and better. So let's make that opportunity and recognise that, as ever, the only hope we have is each other. Let's work to make that good Europe, that democratic Europe. Thank you, everyone, for being here tonight. Let's make that happen. Thank you very much.